It's Friday, October 29, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. In one of the more interesting political developments in recent days, President Barack Obama became the first sitting U.S. president to appear on a comedy news program. He appeared Wednesday night on Comedy Central's Jon Stewart show, and as he sat with the comedian, he found himself answering some fairly difficult questions. Jon Stewart has now become a major figure on the political left. He is also, we might note, along with his colleague on Comedy Central, Stephen Colbert, one of the main informers of young Americans concerning the news. One of the interesting developments in Jon Stewart's pilgrimage on television is how he has moved from a comedian into a far more serious and assertive political figure. When he asked the questions of the president on Wednesday night, he was asking them from the president's left, representing the kind of liberal frustration that is now becoming standard in terms of many on the political left and in the Democratic Party. But what made the incident really interesting was what it says about the presidency. Of course, Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart are heading towards Washington this weekend for what they're calling their Rally to Restore Sanity and or Fear campaign. Now, looking at this particular development is like looking at something of a farce that has become a fact. For some time now, we have been losing the ability to distinguish between entertainment and news, and between irony and serious presentation of events and issues. Well, we shouldn't be surprised then that this president, who has identified himself so much with popular culture, appeared as the first sitting chief executive of this nation on a comedy news program. Looking back, this is not likely to be seen as a bright spot for the presidency and the prestige of his office. At the Washington Post, columnist Dana Milbank suggested that it was the president who was the subject of the last laugh. He pointed to a particular exchange between Jon Stewart and President Obama that cost the presidency a good measure of dignity. Responding to something that President Obama said, Jon Stewart said, "You don't want to use that phrase, dude." As Dana Milbank said, "Dude," the indignity of a comedy show host calling the commander-in-chief dude, pretty well captured the moment for Obama. He was making this first-ever appearance by a president on The Daily Show as part of a long-shot effort to rekindle the spirit of 08. In The Daily Show, Obama had a friendly host and an even friendlier crowd. But, as in his MTV appearance a couple weeks ago, Obama didn't try to connect with his youthful audience. He was serious and defensive, pointing a finger at his host several times as he quarreled with the premise of a question. End quote. The presidency of the United States is an office that demands a certain dignity, gravitas, and weight that is incommensurate with showing up on The Daily Show and becoming a part of the irony of Jon Stewart's act. To see the president of the United States referred to as dude by a television host and directly to the president's face is a low moment for the American presidency. Before leaving the issue of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert as they head for Washington, we should look at an article in the LA Times by Will Bunch, who points out that these particular comedians thrive on irony, and yet they're now entering a kind of political season in which there appears to be very little irony. But Mr. Bunch also points out that they, just like many others who hold events on the mall, are really about selling something. Both of them, we should not be surprised, have new books coming out, quickly available in your local bookstore. Speaking of President Obama, an interesting article appeared at the Washington Post at the Post-Partisan site. Jonathan Capehart writes that President Obama met on Wednesday with a group of progressive bloggers. That meeting, he said, suggests that the president might be moving closer to supporting marriage equality or same-sex marriage. When asked a question about same-sex marriage and its legalization, the president said that he continues to support civil unions instead. But then the president said this, quote, "But I also think you're right that attitudes evolve, including mine. And I think that that is an issue that I wrestle with and think about because I have a whole host of friends who are in gay partnerships. I have staff members who are in committed, monogamous relationships, who are raising children, who are wonderful parents. And I care about them deeply. And so while I'm not prepared to reverse myself here, sitting in the Roosevelt Room at 3:30 in the afternoon, I think it's fair to say that it's something that I think a lot about. That's probably the best you'll do out of me today." End quote. The president here does appear to be sending a signal. But he is also speaking here out of a worldview and a moral position that is increasingly common in postmodern America. It is the idea that there is an inevitable evolution to moral values and, underlying that, to moral truth. The president here is suggesting he himself is evolving on the issue. Many political observers have noted that this president, along with many others, appears to be evolving right along with the safety net they feel in the culture. As soon as the larger culture reaches the tipping point of support for same-sex marriage, it appears that a good number of politicians, perhaps also this president, will then be ready for very active and eager support. The statements given by the president to this group of progressive bloggers, as recited at the Washington Post, is extremely illuminating. It's likely to be a landmark passage that we will remember given subsequent political developments. News out of Great Britain is a reminder of what Time magazine described several years ago as the abortionist fear of the fetus. Citing one abortion provider, Time magazine recited the phrase, "The fetus beat us." Well, not at the Oxford Student Union, at least not this time. Joanna Howe reports that the Oxford Student Union, just before a major public event, forbade a pro-life group on the campus, a recognized group at Oxford University, from showing pictures of the fetus. The pro-life group was singled out from all other student groups for a prior consideration of its materials, lest it be offensive. Officials from the Oxford University Student Union, according to the report, defended their decision to ban every picture of a fetus, deeming them, quote, potentially distressing for someone who had experienced miscarriage or abortion. Now, as this reporter indicates, none of the Pro-Life Society's images presented a fetus that was in any way harmed. The banned materials didn't contain photos of dismembered fetuses. They didn't contain anything hateful or violent. They were pictures that were basically scientific and artistic. They were the similar kinds of pictures that you see regularly on television. Joanna Howe writes of outrage at this kind of censorship. But we should note that more than censorship is going on here. This reveals something deep in terms of the antipathy many now feel toward the fetus. The image of the fetus has transformed the entire abortion equation. As many have noted, the development of high-technology ultrasound, now in 3 and 4 dimensions, has changed the way people look at that solitary inhabitant of the womb. Our eyes lead us to see the basic humanity of the fetus, its personhood, and its life. And so what we have in this new development that was intended basically for diagnosis of prenatal conditions is a witness to the basic personhood and humanity, indeed the sanctity of life, that is present there in the womb. When the pro-abortionist says concerning the ultrasound, when a woman decides not to have an abortion after seeing the image, the fetus, beatus, it's a reminder that the fetus itself is a symbol that calls out to the human conscience. Seeing the fetus, even an image of the fetus, a photograph of the fetus, is just too much for some who want to deny that personhood and close their eyes and their consciences to the reality of the fact that this is a human life in the womb. The Oxford University Student Union has here exercised prior restraint and censorship. It should bear the responsibility for singling out a pro-life group in a way that violates its rights and, frankly, the standard of free speech that should be upheld by any academic institution. But we shouldn't be surprised that there is such antipathy and fear directed toward the fetus, because the fetus is now what the culture of death most fears. The transformations that have occurred in American childhood have been accelerated in recent decades. The 20th century saw almost a redefinition of what it means to be a young person in America, with the development of high schools and the invention of adolescence, and, of course, now the maturing of children at earlier and earlier ages. A witness to this comes in an unexpected source when the Wall Street Journal on Thursday reports an article entitled "Attack of the Tall Dolls." It turns out that major toy manufacturers are now designing dolls to be taller, approximately 24 inches tall, in order to appeal to girls who want girl dolls that look older than the baby dolls they've been carrying around. Girls are leaving behind dolls at earlier and earlier ages. Now, of course, this is of interest to toy manufacturers, and they're leaving these dolls behind because they want to move on to more advanced childhood or youthful activities and toys. Well, the toy manufacturers are responding by now constructing and designing these taller dolls. What I found most interesting in the article, however, is nothing related to dolls, but rather to the changes that are taking place in childhood. There's a new term used in this article I hadn't encountered before. That term is age compression. These observers are suggesting that toys are an indication that childhood is accelerating in terms of development. Children, girls as young as 4 to 7, are finding dolls, well, just something they're going to leave behind. Because even at ages 4 to 7, they're moving on to toys and preoccupations that had previously been the domain of much older girls. Age compression isn't just about dolls and toys. It's about education and the larger culture and entertainment and all the rest. And when it comes to age compression, there should be a significant concern on the part of parents, observers, and all those who love children, after all, for actually being children. Finally, today's New York Times is out with an article suggesting that the Air Force Academy is reporting that about 19% of its cadets last year said they were subjected to unwanted proselytizing. The lead in this article says that an Air Force Academy survey found that 41% of cadets who identified themselves as non-Christian said that they were subjected to unwanted proselytizing at least once or twice last year. Lieutenant General Michael Gould, the Academy superintendent, had resisted disclosing specifics of the survey, but now intends to release some on Friday. Nevertheless, the Associated Press has already obtained a copy of the figures, released them on Thursday, with an article that appears in today's edition of the New York Times. Now, what's going on here? Well, it's actually quite simple. A good deal of pressure has been brought on the Air Force Academy to secularize. Now, the issue here isn't or shouldn't be construed as whether the government has a right to proselytize cadets for Christianity. Of course, it does not. But at the same time, cadets have the right to share their faith with other cadets without any kind of restraint. They do not give up their First Amendment rights of religious liberty when they join the armed services. What is really going on here is an attack by several secularists, one in particular, a man by the name of Mickey Weinstein, who wants to eliminate the kind of Christian influence that is now so prevalent at the Air Force Academy in particular, but the other service academies as well. We'll have to keep our eye on this as an important and developing religious liberty story. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/albertmoeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. On this week's edition of Thinking in Public, my long-format program, you'll find an interview with Eric Foner of Columbia University about his new biography of Abraham Lincoln that deals with Abraham Lincoln and the ordeal of slavery. It's a fascinating conversation. You'll find that at iTunes under Thinking in Public, or go to albertmoeller.com, where you will find both The Briefing and Thinking in Public and other resources as well. Thanks for listening. I'll meet you on Monday for The Briefing.